Well, good morning. The first case on the docket this morning is United States versus Claxton. Are the parties ready? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellate.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Jarrett Murk.
Could you speak up, please, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Major Jarrett Murk, and along with Colonel Jeffrey Palomino, represent the appellant, Cadet Stephon Claxton. This court should have no confidence in the outcome of Cadet Claxton's trial because the government withheld evidence that would have dramatically changed the landscape of the case. Cadet Claxton does not carry any burden, but there are at least two reasons why the government cannot prove that its Brady violation was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. First, disclosure would have significantly weakened the government's evidence. Second, disclosure would have unraveled the government's friends and theme and theory that they used to bind its evidence together and also bolster its circumstantial inferences. Moving on to the admissions, the statements by Cadet Claxton would have been perceived by the members in a completely different light had the government complied with its Brady obligation.
Why is that? Why would these admissions by appellant, which were very damaging to his case, have been in any way, the effect of them would have been reduced in any way if the panel members had realized the status of the confidential informant?
Your Honor, trial counsel in his closing sold the statements by Cadet Claxton as admissions to his friends, and the context of it was perceived by the members was that he's a guilty person with a guilty conscience who's just telling his friends what happened.
Now, when you say that, though, in terms of MI, there was an email from the appellant that wasn't to his friends, it was to his parents. So how does that fit? And in terms of SW, it was a statement to OSI.
Well, there's two parts to that. I'll take Cadet MI first. The text messages came about only the members never knew how the text messages came about. Had they known, they would have seen that the text messages only came about after Cadet ET and CI2 had questioned Cadet Claxton. They relentlessly questioned him. At that point, Cadet Claxton was saying, nothing happened. He was denying everything happened. Only after their questioning, going back to him saying, well, she says this is what happened, why would she lie? I'm isolating him for almost a month after that, branding him a rapist in the minds of his fellow classmates at the academy, who he sees every day. Only then did those text messages come about. And as far as the OSI statements, Your Honor, those are cause and effect.
So why does that affect the credibility of that statement?
Cadet ET and CI2 had engaged in a coercive series of peer pressure and demands, and Cadet Claxton says in his statement he doesn't remember everything that happened. His memory of that evening is not 100%. And Cadet ET is going in there and he is filling in the blanks. This is his friend. Cadet Claxton believes this is his friend. Why would his friend lie to him? And Cadet ET convinces him, fills in the blanks of what happened, and that explains why in the statements you see that Cadet Claxton admits to what he's been told happened, and then in SW he says, well, I must have done something. I believe I did something, even though I have no memory of what happened.
Well, so is it your theory that these informants brainwashed the accused into making admissions that he otherwise would not have made? What are you saying?
In part, yes. He said things that he didn't believe. Cadet Claxton didn't believe or didn't know if they were true. And that's
what he believed. Do what? Curry favor with these informants?
No, Your Honor. He believed, he was convinced by his friends that he must have
done something. Okay, so he was brainwashed. He was basically, he came to believe things that were not so or that he did not know were so.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, With that theory, where is that supported in the record, that he was brainwashed? Where is there testimony or evidence on that point?
Well, if you look at what his statement is to OSI, especially on SW, he says that I believe I did something, but he doesn't. He's filling in the gaps. He's taking OSI at that point. His friends had all believed that he's a rapist. They were calling him that night, and that's because of Cadet E.T. I'm telling them that he was a rapist, planting the seeds. He believed that Cadet E.T. and the second CI are his friends, and they're...
But isn't there a problem with that in terms of SW in particular, where you've got the testimony of the appellant talking about kissing the victim, where there was no evidence out there? That, in fact, that charge was dismissed because there was zero corroborating evidence. So how does that fit with this theory that these ideas were planted in his brain, that he was brainwashed on this?
Well, it's not that he was necessarily brainwashed. He has gaps in his memory. He doesn't remember what all happened, the extent of what happened that night, and he's filling in the blanks with what he's convinced that his friends believe he's done. And he's accepted that, and even though he has no memory of actually doing it. And as far as the statements which were uncorroborated, those wouldn't even be admissible. So the members would not have been able to even hear that evidence. So the strength of the government's case, you have to kind of peel back the layers of all the impermissible argument in the analysis of whether these members would have came to the same verdict. Peel back those layers of impermissible argument by the government, impermissible propensity evidence that came in, and the uncorroborated evidence in seeing if these members would have come to the same verdict. And the government cannot carry that burden because this would have shown that in a completely different context, these statements were extracted by that ET and the other CI and basically had convinced him that he had done what they said he did. And the government effectively used that friends, capitalized on the friends theory throughout the entirety of their case, and especially when you're looking at how they bolstered the inferences with SW, how all of Cadet Claxton's friends, like Cadet Burns, assumed the worst, and they presented it as the situation was so obvious that she was partially unclothed, that she was with Cadet Claxton. The government presented that as so obvious that the only outcome was that he intended to rape her or sexually assault her, and that he must have touched her and unbuttoned her clothes.
Counsel, what are we to make of the military judge's findings here that the confidential informant's testimony was not credible during the debate? That, in fact, he was not a CI at the time of these offenses?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, the Dubé military judge should get no deference on that. That finding is a conclusion of law that's under the guise of a finding of fact. Whether Cadet E.T. was a confidential informant at that time it's not really relevant. What was relevant, what she should have been analyzing, was in light of Cadet E.T.'s testimony, would appellant's members come to the same verdict, and can the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they would have come to the same verdict? And she did not engage in that analysis. She effectively said she didn't believe Cadet E.T., so I guess you could read into that the members wouldn't believe that, so and failing to disclose that was harmless beyond reasonable doubt because it never happened, but that's not the analysis. The analysis is dealing with conflicting information that would have been should have been presented to the members, and the analysis is what...
Well, was the holding, was the finding that he wasn't working for him then? I think everyone admits that at some point he was working for him.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that clearly erroneous? It seems like he certainly had some contact with them and that they had some leverage over him because of his own prior misconduct. Or when did that come in?
The finding that she made that Cadet E.T. didn't believe that he was a confidential informant at the end of 2010 to target Claggett.
Well, you know, that's his belief. Like, I tend to agree with you that that's a question of law.
Yes, and her finding.
But my question is, when? Was he working for him when all this took place?
Yes, Your Honor. According to Cadet E.T.'s testimony, he believed that he was a confidential informant when Special Agent Munson gave him the soft pitch.
Promises had been made and information extracted.
Well,
had been made by the OSI.
According to
and information extracted by the OSI from him. I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor. Cadet E.T. says that the relationship began at the end of 2010, and in fact, he even talks about when the Cadet M.I. On that evening, that he was trying to reach Special Agent Munson in that fact.
But wouldn't that make the CI curiously ineffective and lazy? In terms of the M.I. incident, he didn't report it to OSI for months. In terms of SW, didn't report it for weeks and until after OSI had initiated the conversation. So how is he serving as a CI if he's sitting back, he knows about two sexual assaults, and he's not reporting it?
Well, speaking to the Cadet MI incident first, Your Honor, that ended up in a restricted report, so Cadet E.T. didn't believe that he could tell OSI, and according to his testimony, he says that he told Special Agent Munson that there was an incident and was told not to go any further because he couldn't, he would have to investigate it. So he was respecting the privacy of Cadet MI in that sense, and that's why it didn't go any further.
Just to be clear, because I want to be clear in my own mind, but that conversation about the restricted report, are you saying that happened early in the process, or did that not happen until months after the incident occurred?
I believe that happened early in the process, Your Honor. That was a conversation that he said took place, and that was why he didn't report that. He didn't make a further report of that information. Effectively, OSI told him not to go any further. With SW, he was a part of that, and while OSI didn't talk to him at that point, you also have to remember that his contact with OSI was no longer, he couldn't reach him anymore because Special Agent Munson had deployed at that time. And there is testimony, Cadet E.T. does give testimony that he had tried and failed on other occasions with the victim that he was acquitted on, that he had trouble reaching Special Agent Munson. But at that point, he was questioned by his command. OSI was already involved in that, and he knew it was a matter of time before he would talk to him. And he perceived that OSI knew he was a confidential informant. And that testimony is also corroborated by the special agent. The special agent says that months before trial, Cadet Claxton's trial in April or March, that Cadet E.T. told him that he was working with Special Agent Munson. So there's no reason to doubt that he would not have testified, Cadet E.T. would not have testified the exact same as he did at the Dubay hearing, had the government not told him to testify only as a witness, or had the prosecutor done their duty and asked the obvious question of when you have a CI who's claiming that he was working with, he was previously working with the OSI, asked the simple question of, what were you doing? At this point, it's almost like the trial counsel in Stilato saying, I don't want to know what's in the box. This all would have come out had they asked these questions, and there's no reason to believe otherwise. This isn't a new motive that came up. And had that come out, the scope of what he was doing and what he was engaging in would have drastically changed how the case would have been presented to the members. It would have changed how the defense would have characterized the witnesses and would have been able to combat that these are not his friends, that Cadet E.T. behind every piece of the government's evidence, you see Cadet E.T.'s fingerprints. Cadet M.I. testified that she felt Cadet Claxton's penis touch her. But the evidence shows that CI-2 had talked to her, and it's questionable whether she actually perceived that she touched Cadet Claxton's penis, or it was a suggestion that what you felt was Cadet Claxton's penis because it's uncircumcised.
These people seem awfully suggestible for a bunch of future Air Force leaders.
I think
what's going on here?
To some degree, I think you have to look at the age and the experience of the people you're dealing with. They're in the Air Force Academy. They're young cadets. They're in a very shielded environment, and they're told to learn to trust each other. And they're friends, and they have no reason to doubt what's going on. And
she said he did it. She said she felt it, and that's something you don't go to the confidential informant for. You got it from her.
Yes, Your Honor, but the theory doesn't make sense that she could have adopted a suggestion by Cadet E.T. or the CI-2 unless you know that Cadet E.T. is a CI. That wouldn't have even been able to present to the members.
Well, I'm not sure it makes sense even if you know what, but that's neither here nor there.
But the fact of whether this court is convinced that that would have changed the outcome is not necessarily the analysis. It's whether the members at Cadet Claxton's trial would have been convinced. And it's the cumulative effect of all these lines of attack that the defense should have been able to make and should have been able to counter the government's theory that they were deprived of. If you look at the cumulative effect of that, the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the members would have come to that same verdict.
Counsel, both parties agree that harmlessness beyond reasonable doubt is the appropriate standard here. Do you quibble with the concept that we have to look at as a court whether there was a reasonable probability that there would have been a different outcome in the proceedings?
I'm Chief Judge Erdman. I see that I'm
out. You can respond to the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. A reasonable probability of a different result is the standard. We don't quibble with that, but if there's a reasonable probability of a reasonable doubt, a reasonable probability of an acquittal, then the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the members would have come to the same verdict. Because it's not that the members could have come to the same verdict that they need to prove, it's the members would have come to the same verdict.
Thank you, Counsel. You'll have additional time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. First of all, I apologize, I'm losing my voice, but I'll do the best that I can to make it through the next 20 minutes or so. The government's failure to disclose Cadet E.T.'s status as a confidential informant prior to appellant's trial was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt due to the overwhelming nature of the evidence against appellant. Appellant himself admitted to causing Cadet M.I.'s hand to touch his penis as charged in the specification of Charge 2. Furthermore, four cadets other than Cadet E.T. described S.W. as being passed out and incoherent, and five cadets other than Cadet E.T. observed S.W.'s pants unbuttoned after appellant locked himself in a room with her. And then appellant admitted he strongly believed it was possible that he unbuttoned S.W.'s pants as charged in the specification of Charge 1 and in Charge 3 specification.
Well, counsel, the government had a case. But isn't this kind of explosive stuff? How can we be sure that the result would have been the same if you throw into this mess the bomb that says, oh, and by the way, these guys, his putative friends, were actually confidential informants being run as part of an OSI operation, in trouble themselves and desperate to maintain the favor of the OSI. How you throw that into the calculus, how can you, how's it HBRD?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are two reasons for that. And one is that when all the evidence actually came out, all this impeachment evidence actually came out and was presented to the members, it was not going to be particularly compelling, and it would not have caused the members to doubt the credibility of Cadet Antonio's testimony.
Why not?
Well, Your Honor, if we look at the testimony that would have come out, there simply is not any evidence that, other than what Cadet E.T. was saying, which was firmly contradicted by all the other OSI agents in this case, that he was actually working as a confidential informant.
Well, he thought he was, and he was providing them with information which they were using as part of a criminal investigation. So whether they thought he was or not, he's certainly trying to curry favor with them, isn't he?
And they thought enough of him that they were willing and wanting to go speak on his behalf at his disenrollment hearing, but were prevented from doing that. So obviously they thought he was a valuable person, and they thought he was not treated fairly.
Well, Your Honor, but I think the fact that he was valuable suggests that he was providing credible information. And certainly I believe that...
you can't have it both ways.
Well, he was providing... that says he was providing credible information as a CI. The point is, Your Honor, he wasn't providing them with false testimony. He wasn't making up these allegations.
But that's the question that would have been for the members. That would have been a question for the members to decide, and I think that the point of the questions here are that they did not get to hear all the information that may have weighed in their decision as to whether, in fact, he was credible.
Well, Your Honor, I think
you don't disagree that if someone might have something to gain, that is a basis to impugn their credibility, right?
I do, Your Honor, and I think that's why the evidence was discoverable and it should have been discovered.
What about the second informant? That even when you had a debate hearing, right, about confidential informant number one, you still didn't disclose that it was confidential informant number two, who was one of the two witnesses to the incident involving MI.
And so that was not fully explored at the Dubay hearing,
this is not a matter of being fully explored. This is a matter of the government knows it's having a Dubay hearing because it didn't disclose the first confidential informant. So instead of manning up and saying, oh, and by the way, we also had a second one, like you didn't disclose that either.
Well, it was the government, Your Honor, who did provide that email to the court.
But it's a little late, and here we have what appears to be an intentional discovery withholding of discovery. This wasn't an inadvertent. I mean, the OSI specifically said, we don't want you to disclose that you're a confidential informant. And wasn't there some discussion with the trial counsel?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's any information in the record that this was discussed with trial counsel. With the Chief of Justice in the office, yes, but I'm not sure that the actual individuals prosecuted.
Well, so that's the government, though. That's the government.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And really, there's nothing to say. I mean, it was error not to disclose.
There was more than error. It was a lie. It was obfuscation by the government. The government is supposed to cut square corners. The government is the sovereign. The defense isn't. The government's supposed to cut square corners. What are we to think now of the government doing this kind of thing just to run a secret agent operation in the football team?
Well, Your Honor, whether or not it was intentional, if it was intentional, that still doesn't change the standard.
It sounds pretty intentional to this judge.
Well, Your Honor, assuming, agreeing if it is intentional, then it, at the end of the day, it doesn't change the standard that this court uses to review whether or not the error was harmless. The government has
the
burden.
If the members had known all of this, it still would have been harmless.
Yes, Your Honor, it absolutely would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And you have to, again, look at the strength of the evidence. And you have to look at the fact that the verdict in this case did not hinge on Cadet E.T.'s credibility, and it did not hinge on cadet, or I'm sorry, on CI2's.
Well, the government certainly spent a lot of time at the trial bolstering his credibility by talking about, obviously he's telling the truth here because he's a friend of his, and so this is difficult for him to do.
But
I mean, they spent a lot of time on his credibility.
Your Honor, I think, though, if you look at what is the entire context of what happened and what's really important in judging credibility, the members were instructed about many things that they were supposed to consider. But they were also told that they were supposed to consider the extent to which each witness is supported or contradicted by the other evidence. And so the best evidence that the government had to Cadet E.T.'s credibility and even to CI2's credibility was the fact that their testimony was corroborated by so many other witnesses in the case, to the extent that it was basically just cumulative.
Would you agree, counsel, that the state of the weight of evidence with respect to MI is less weighty than it is with respect to the evidence regarding SW and the assaults?
Well, Your Honor, I somewhat agree with that.
Because, you know, with respect to one, there's like a bunch of people that, like, you know that he locks the door, know that he locked the door, and know that he comes out and see that her pants are undone, right?
Well, but Your Honor, I think with what we have with the MI incident is we have MI herself testifying to the events that occurred.
I'm not arguing that there is evidence. I mean, he himself made a statement that was inculpatory, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And he sent the text to his mother, right?
Right.
Which is also not good. Like that's yes. That those are bad
very
things
strong.
If you're the defense counsel.
Very strong for the government. Right.
So is your point, I mean, I take it that appellant's point is that we should ignore all this evidence and just say, oh my gosh, they all somehow got, I don't know what the word is, boondoggled, because of the CI. And your point is we should not care because unless the members were engaging in jury nullification because they hated what the government did, they still would have come to the same result.
Your Honor, I think that's exactly the point. I mean, if you look at the evidence, the members can't make a decision based on emotions because they hate what the government did.
What's your response to what are we to make of what the government did? I mean, I understand that that's a different point than harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard. But, I mean, you just do this with impunity and that's that.
Well, Your Honor, I
realize when I say you, I don't mean you personally, but
I
unfortunately are standing here.
I am standing here.
Right?
Yes.
Because you get to do so often.
Yes, Your Honor. I think, you know, certainly it will come out that what the government did is wrong. It was error. But I believe this court's job is not necessary. There are other avenues potentially for the government to be sanctioned or for investigations.
Well, what have you guys done? I mean, did anything happen?
Well, Your Honor, I think in the Dubé hearing, you could hear that there was an IG investigation that was further exploring what happened in this particular case. I mean, other than that, I can't. It's not within the record to say what happened, but certainly, I think what this court at the end of the day has to look at to decide whether or not appellant was prejudiced was to look at what the effect was on his trial.
Well, you assert, and probably properly, that the members, if they knew all this dirt, nonetheless should set aside emotion, but the members are the triers of fact, and they're in that respect, they're unreviewable, essentially. And if they want to decide it on emotion, they can decide it on emotion. And no one is going to second guess them.
You can't argue, I don't think, that absolutely this would have had no effect on the members. That in fact, that two of the main witnesses and two of the people that this guy thought were his friends were in fact working for the government to whatever degree that was. Now, that may not have much effect, it may have a lot of effect, but it has to have some effect on members' determinations when they're deciding credibility. And you said we have to look at everything when we look at credibility. Well, we have to look at everything except the fact that these guys were working for the government, and that doesn't matter. That's not a part of this equation. That's where I just see your logic not being consistent.
Well, Your Honor, the members will look at everything, but at the end of the day, it's their duty to determine whether or not that witness is telling the truth.
They'll look at everything that they're given. But if they're not given that, how do they look at it? How do they know? How do they gauge that?
Well, Your Honor, let's assume that they did look at it. Let's say that the information came out in the worst possible way for the government as far as ETs and the other confidential informants.
And then let's assume that the credibility of those two witnesses were completely shot.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if I would go that far, but just playing along with you and agreeing with you, saying that the members totally disregarded their testimony. Neither of those witnesses really provided any unique testimony.
No, but not just disregarded, thought that they were lying.
Okay, so thought that they were lying, Your Honor. That still wouldn't...
That's different.
I'm sorry?
That's different. Like, yes. They made it up.
Okay, so assuming that they made that up, I still don't believe that that is going to call into question the credibility of the four other, for example, the four other cadets who testified to seeing...
And they wouldn't be concerned that one of the confidential informants was actually active in engineering these encounters to a certain degree, inviting the young women, leaving the young woman in a room where with a person who they had claimed was a rapist after everybody was drunk. Now, how does that coincide with a government agent's responsibility?
Your Honor, I just think that that's a bridge too far to suggest.
But it could be argued.
It could be argued, Your Honor, but just because something is argued doesn't mean that the members would find it plausible.
Absolutely.
Right.
But certainly the defense has that opportunity.
They did, but Your Honor, if they had advanced that theory at trial, it just, when you look at the entire rest of the facts that were presented by the government, it simply just would not have been believable. It doesn't help to explain appellant's confessions away.
Well, here we are today arguing the case. The government still does not want to disclose the identity of the second informant. The government asked us to close this courtroom to the public.
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the government has always had the position that we do not need to close the court to the public because argument can be presented without revealing the identity.
But the reason given in the motion was that the second informant would feel the disapproval of his colleague. Would maybe be persecuted. Maybe he would be, although I don't think any of us agrees that that's a reason for closing the courtroom to the public. But it does seem to, you know, if this wasn't that important in the calculus of things, why is the government to this day scurrying around trying to hide his identity?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that I have a good answer to that.
Thank
right.
You. That's
okay.
That's fine.
How
about that's why they're called confidential informants? Because they're confidential.
Right, Your Honor, and it's not necessary. I guess what I'll say is maybe the parties to the trial, the parties to this litigation, they need to know that, or they need to know it to be able to litigate and ensure that appellant receives a fair trial.
Counsel, do you understand the deep concern we would have when the government violates the constitutional rights of an accused, essentially gives itself the whip hand in the court-martial about how an accused can present his or her own case. And then the government comes before us and says, well, everything that the defense is saying they might have presented at during the course of the court-martial is speculative and doesn't matter. Do you understand why we would have grave concern about that situation?
I do, Your Honor, but the simple fact of the matter is that this is an error, but it's not a structural error. And so this court does have to engage in a harmlessness analysis, and it's a high standard, but not an impossible standard, harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. So yes, the government is standing up here today and saying absolutely that there was an error that should not have occurred in this case, but all that we can ask this court to do is treat this error as this court is required to, which is not a structural error, but under a harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And so when in doing that, this court must look at the strength of the evidence. It must look at and analyze de novo what the members would have done had they received this evidence into trial. And when we do that, the only conclusion to come to is that this is a very, very strong, it was a very, very, very strong case against appellant. Even if we completely disregard the testimony of Cadet E.T. and the other confidential informant.
Did they testify with respect to the offenses that he was found not guilty of?
I believe at least one of them did, Your Honor.
So when we look at this, are we looking at what these particular panel members would have done, or are we using a reasonable person standard as the stand-ins for panel members in a case such as this?
Well, Your Honor, I think we are supposed to look at this from the question of whether or not, or I think we always assume that the members would have followed the military judge's instructions. And so I'm not sure that we can get into the minds of the members. And so I think we have to consider that they did indeed follow the military judge's instructions as they were required to do. And from that standpoint, I think it is what a reasonable juror who had heard that particular evidence would have done, a reasonable juror who was following the military judge's instructions as they were required to do. I do, just in the short amount of time that I have left, I do want to, again, just with regard to the strength of the case involving SW, I just don't think that it can be emphasized enough that to the essential facts of that case, the fact that SW's condition and the fact that her pants were unbuttoned, four cadets who were not confidential informants testified to those facts. And that is very strong evidence in this case. And even had Cadet E.T. and the other CI been impeached, it would not have affected the outcome of appellant's trial. And Chief Judge, may I briefly conclude?
You briefly conclude, please.
There was no possibility that the disclosure of Cadet E.T.'s status as a CI would have affected the outcome of appellant's trial. The disclosure error in this case was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we ask this court to affirm AFCA's decision below. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll now hear rebuttal.
Counsel, my question for you is, on what basis, other than some sort of a Vulcan mind meld caused by the machinations of these CIs, did the appellant confess to touching MI's hand with his penis, or putting her hands on his penis, and caused her to think that had happened, and caused him to send a text to his mother that he'd done something wrong? Boy, just explain that to me, because that seems to be your argument, and I frankly don't understand it.
Yes, Your Honor. And what I think you have to look at is how this would have been presented to the members, because the members were to make this determination.
Right. These other two people are big, fat liars. How does that affect what the appellant said that he had done, and how does that affect what the victim said had happened?
Well, you have to look at how those statements came about, and they only came about after the Cadet E.T. and CI-2 had questioned him relentlessly, had engaged in social isolation techniques, had spread rumors and branded him a rapist.
So they brainwashed him into convicting himself, and they brainwashed her into saying that it happened.
To a certain extent, I mean, but
that's a reasonable doubt.
No, I think you have to look at it and how it would.
I understand. I don't like what happened here. I don't think any of us did. But there's still a legal standard that we have to apply. And what you're talking about isn't a reasonable possibility. It's a highly speculative, bridge too far.
I disagree that it's highly speculative. These members, the admissions were important to him. We're not saying that Cadet Claxton doesn't argue to ignore those. That was strong evidence, and that was important to the members because the members convicted where there were statements and acquitted where there weren't statements. And the government hid the context. They sold these statements to the jury as if these were, the guilty conscience and admissions to friends, and that's not what happened. Cadet Claxton maintained
his innocence. What about the text to his mother? He texted his mother.
He sent an email.
Text email to his mother saying, I did something bad.
Yes, Your Honor, but that was only in response to Cadet E.T. and C.I.T. saying, you need to do something, you need to take responsibility, socially isolating him and creating this pressure on him to do something to appease them. And he said, states.
Appease them?
Well, to get them back in the groups so they relieve the peer pressure that they're engaging in and the isolation tactics.
Like Lord of the Flies?
No, Your Honor, but I mean, I think you have to look at the environment of the Air Force Academy, and you have to actually also see that Cadet Claxton didn't remember. He didn't have a full memory of this, and his friends are telling him that he did it, and he is accepting that.
And how did they get her to say that he'd done it?
Well, the question of...
Did they isolate her?
I don't think they isolated her, but if she's confused, she's in a drunken state. There was a lot of confusion, the testimony is then. And you look at it, and they don't... She's highly suggestible, and they're saying they're the ones putting into her mind, well, what you touched is his penis because it was uncircumcised.
These are going to be the future leaders of the Air Force.
I think you have to look at it as they would. I'm sorry, Your Honor. May I?
You may conclude.
If the government is wrong on the standard, it is not a reasonable panel. It is this panel, and this court found that in U.S. v. Bass. And they want to ignore the cumulative effect approach and engage in an individualized analysis. The case does not hinge on the credibility of Cadet E.T. It's not just that he wasn't. Cadet Claxton wasn't able to impeach Cadet E.T. He wasn't able to use that defense counsel wasn't able to use that information in his theory of the case, in his tactics, in his cross-examinations, and his closing summation, and how that would have been done, and how that would have completely changed the presentation to the members. Add all that up, and the government cannot say that totally different trial, those same members would have come to the same result, and that's why they cannot carry their burden. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and court will be in recess until 10:25.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:25.